Hello and welcome. This is Kieran Riley. I am hosting today Douglas Sloan here in the studio at WGXC. You're listening to 90.7 Community Radio here in Hudson. And Douglas Sloan is going to be chatting with us for a little short while. And he is retired professor
emeritus
at from Columbia University and currently resides in Ghent, New York, just close by to us. So hello, Douglas Sloan, and
Hello. Welcome
to the studio.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here with us. And partly what we're going to be talking about is, well, there's a weekend coming up this weekend celebrating the 150th birthday of Rudolf Steiner. Mm-hmm. So we are going to dig in a little bit and find out from you, Mr. Sloan, who Rudolf Steiner was and why we are celebrating his 150th. And we'll also just be highlighting a little bit of the work in our local area that some of our listeners may or may not be aware of, that he is partially responsible for, mm-hmm. at least, or his impulse. So why don't we just start right off, and let me ask you, first of all, this weekend we have a PSA up explaining a little bit about the schedule, but could you just tell us briefly where this event is and which days?
Yeah, it's going to begin Friday evening, go all day Saturday, and into the evening, and then all day Sunday until I think about 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
Okay.
And it'll be in Space 360.
Okay, great. And we're going to have more information on that specifically. There's just scores of speakers, wonderful mm-hmm. speakers, a lot of folks who I'm familiar with, you are, I'm assuming, as well,
yep.
Who are going to be mostly giving talks, and maybe there'll be some musical presentations and possibly some drama, I don't know. So
I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'll
schedule,
come back
but
to that.
There'll be a lot of different variety.
Great. So it's going to be a packed weekend over there at Space 360. That would be number 360 Warren Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be a fantastic weekend. So why don't we just dive right in here and let's just give a brief or just give a background of who was Rudolf Steiner?
Okay. Well, in the most general terms, he was a scientist and a philosopher and an artist, a spiritual researcher. he was born in a town by the name of Kraljevec, which today is in Croatia, but mm-hmm. at the time was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Okay.
and he led a very active life, trying to bring new forces of thinking and social reform, and has been responsible for many, many movements today that are actually growing worldwide in mm-hmm. agriculture, in medicine, education, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We could go into those if
sure.
you wish in
sure.
due course.
And before we do that, just let's talk a little bit about his work. His work primarily was written. Is that correct? Or
Well,
explain that.
This is one of the challenges in getting to know Steiner, because he gave over 6,000 lectures in his life.
6,000 lectures.
6,000 lectures. They were transcribed by a stenographer, and they've since been edited and many of them published. The complete works now total something over 400 volumes, and it's still not complete. And what he did, he lectured, he wrote a few basic books, so-called basic books, but most of the books are compilations of his lecture series that he gave all over Europe, including England and Prague and France, as well as Germany and Switzerland. So it's a vast corpus.
Okay, now I just want to clarify.
It's all available.
Okay, I just want to clarify. I have read, I believe, a couple of his books, and
mm-hmm.
you say basic books, but there's nothing basic about them.
No.
In a sense, they're actually somewhat complicated and very interesting reading.
Yeah, one of the problems is that there is no one book that serves as a kind of cliff notes for Rudolf
mm-hmm.
Steiner that
right.
doesn't that summarizes the basics. There are a number of books that he wrote. That's what are often referred to as the basic books.
Right.
As opposed to his lectures, which are then transcribed. And some of them are very difficult. Some of them are I won't say easy, never easy, but straightforward and not terribly difficult to penetrate, but some of them are very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how many of these kind of core or basic books would you say there are, roughly?
I think roughly there are about four or five.
Right. Okay. So four or five books and then thousands and thousands of lectures.
And the lectures are gathered together according... See, often he would lecture in a series. Mm-hmm. So he'd have a series on a topic, like the boundaries of natural science.
Mm-hmm.
So he might give 10 lectures in that series. So they are bound together in one volume.
Right.
Like under that title, the boundaries of natural science.
Or like the bee lectures.
That's right.
Or, or the agriculture lectures. A lot of folks out there listening may be familiar with the biodynamic movement and the biodynamics.
Right.
And that came out of the agriculture lecture. So that's actually not a book, technically, that he wrote.
No, he gave it as a set of lectures.
Right.
And he worked with... Farmers came to him around 1924 and said, we're really concerned about the decline of the quality of the soil and the quality of our foodstuffs. Can you help us? Now, that was a pattern that Steiner often... I would even say usually followed, which was he didn't push his ideas on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He waited till someone came and said, can you help us in this area?
Mm-hmm.
And if he felt they were serious, and if he felt he could, then he would throw himself into it wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
So a group of farmers came asking, can you help us improve the state of agriculture? And so he met with them. He met with them, gave a series of lectures on agriculture, laid the basis for what's come to be called biodynamic farming. And the farmers picked it up, and then he continued to work with them. And that was the beginning of the biodynamic movement, which mm-hmm. is one aspect of the larger organic movement today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
we,
unique aspect.
We have, that's one of the things we have reported on the radio here.
Mm-hmm.
I have a show second Monday of the month from 2 to 3 p.m. during our agricultural section. And I try to talk a lot about what's happening in biodynamics and do a little of the reading from the Stella Natura calendar and explaining what it is. And so we'll just mention, yes, biodynamics mm-hmm. was founded on the insights and lectures given by Rudolf Steiner, which sometimes that gets left out of the equation.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So
it's not unusual that he gets left out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find that interesting. So why don't we talk a little more about the other areas where the work is continued today? And expanding on.
Okay, we could go all the way back to the early part of the century when he was really a member of the Theosophical Society for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And during those years between, say, 1900 and 1912, 13, well, all the way up to the First World War, he was very active in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
he wrote some drama. He called them mystery plays. He developed a new art of movement. He worked in color theory with a number of artists. He became very influential among the avant-garde art scene early in the century. He also designed a magnificent wooden building with a unique system of interlocking cupolas or domes, which hadn't really been done before. As the center for his activities, he'd been given a plot of land in Dornach, Switzerland, and that's where he built the Gertianum. That's what he called the building. I should explain.
Right.
He was very, very influenced, and we could go into this a little bit, by the work of Wolfgang von Goethe, the poet, the writer of Faust, who also was a scientist.
So this is, let's back up, a German writer, poet, scientist, thinker, amazing individual, and we're talking, was this 1700s, I believe, or how, when was Goethe alive?
I think he died around 1832, like that.
Okay, so late 1700s, early 1800s,
yeah.
So he influenced Steiner?
When Steiner was about, should I backtrack a little bit on
sure.
his education, because that
sure.
will help explain why Goethe became so important,
yeah.
and why this building that he designed, he called the Gertianum, kind of a jawbreaker of a title,
yeah.
but still it reflects his admiration and the influence of Goethe on him. Steiner attended, after going to the village school where he was born, he attended the Vienna Technical Institute, which people have said was kind of the MIT of Vienna at the time. Mm-hmm. And he majored in science. He took chemistry, physics, and mathematics. But then he also became acquainted with literature and poetry and philosophy and came to the attention of a leading Goethe scholar at the time. And when Steiner was 23, this Goethe scholar recommended him to work on an edition of Goethe's scientific works, which was being prepared for an edition of German classics. And he worked on this for several years in Vienna, produced one of the definitive editions of Goethe's scientific work. And then he was recommended for a study in Weimar, in the Goethe archives, the Schiller-Goethe archives in Weimar.
Okay, I'm just going to say this is our CSX train coming through. This happens just about every interview. You're listening to WGXC 90.7. This is Kieran Riley, your host, and I'm with Douglas Sloan here in the studio. And we are doing a little bit of a biography on Rudolf Steiner, whose 150th birthday would be his 150th birthday being celebrated this weekend in Hudson at Space 360. So you were saying, we were talking about Weimar. So mm-hmm. In Weimar, what happened?
He worked on the Goethe scientific work in Vienna, and then he was recommended to spend a team in Weimar working on another edition of Goethe's scientific works. And he spent 7 years in Weimar mm-hmm. doing this. Now, the reason that Goethe appealed to him was that Goethe also had spent about a quarter of a century not only writing poetry like Faust, but also doing scientific work in botany, morphology, meteorology, color theory, and it was a qualitative science as opposed to a quantitative science. Now, for nearly a century after Goethe wrote, scientists tended to look down on his scientific work as being the work of a poet mm-hmm. and an amateur. They didn't take it seriously. But Steiner had produced commentaries along with his edition of the scientific work that really pulled out the heart of what Goethe was trying to do. And after World War II, the quantum physicist Werner Heisenberg gave a lecture in which he said, you know, maybe we should take a new look at Goethe and not simply write him off because he was doing qualitative as opposed to mechanistic quantitative science. And a real reappraisal of Goethe has taken place since World War II, in which Steiner's works, earlier works, have been very important. The reason that Steiner was interested in him was that he found in Goethe, right there in the heart of Western culture, a person doing a qualitative science. In other words, looking not at what you can count, measure, and weigh, the quantities, but looking at life in nature, the wholeness of the organism rather than the mechanistic parts, using his imagination to follow through the plant life and bring out not simply treating the plant like a machine, but treating the plant like a living being that can be understood, and actually also taking account of things like growth, development, beauty. So Steiner's main interest was to develop an approach to the world that can give us real knowledge of the qualities, the qualities of beauty, truth, goodness, as well as the ordinary qualities of sound, color, life. So Steiner did a lot. This is why Goethe really appealed to him, because he felt, here I can show already somebody that I can connect with and make contact with as a basis for what I want to develop even farther. Mm-hmm. And Steiner's whole emphasis, as I would put it, is to really develop a qualitative science of the world mm-hmm. and of the human being that was kind of pioneered in a very beginning way by Goethe, that Steiner then felt he could build on and develop farther.
So it's very encompassing, a very encompassing work that covers probably every aspect of life in a way.
It does indeed.
and
every aspect.
Yeah, and enters into realms of seeing or trying to identify certain forces that you don't see that are really hard to measure. Some people say, well, we don't have the instruments to measure some of these things. Like, for example, before they had magnets, there was magnetism was always there. But like in biodynamics, you hear often with the compost and the preparations, this idea of life forces.
Yes.
So like the forces of growth that aren't necessarily perceptible by instruments or the naked eye. But you wanna, could you just explain what are life forces? What are these forces that, I guess what I'm asking is, do you have to be a clairvoyant? Steiner was considered to be a pretty advanced clairvoyant, be able to see through the essence of a living thing or anything. But not all of us are. So for those of us who aren't clairvoyant, how is this science helpful? It's a vague question. I'm sorry.
Well, let me try to respond out of the way I would think, venture to say that maybe Steiner would have responded. I'm not sure.
Okay.
What Steiner was really... Well, let's talk about clairvoyance for a minute. If you look in the dictionary, it says heightened sensitivity in perception. Mm-hmm. It's not something mysterious. It's that we all have capacities within us for developing greater and greater sensitivity. The modern world says we can't have any knowledge of anything that doesn't come to us through sense experience. And Steiner maintained that we can develop this sensitivity to such an extent that we can also begin to perceive and work with non-sensory realities. And I think this is my own way of seeing it. I see non-sensory realities as including things like values, purpose, meaning, and the qualities of the world, not just the secondary qualities like color and sound, but what the philosophers in their way, with their jargon, call tertiary qualities. Mm-hmm. Truth, beauty, goodness, selves, beings, that these are non-sensory realities. Ideas are non-sensory realities, and that's often forgot in the modern world, that thinking. So Steiner said that everybody has the possibility of developing this higher sensitivity. I think it's the first sentence in one of his basic books called Knowledge of Higher Worlds and Its Attainment that begins, every human being has slumbering in them the capacity for higher knowledge. And he gave many, many exercises that students of Steiner can follow to develop in these different ways. We could go into that later. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to extend knowledge into the whole realm of the non-sensory. And that's not mysterious, because you can't even do empirical quantitative science if you don't have ideas, if you don't have ideals, if you don't have a sense of truth, if you can't follow a logical train of thought, if you don't think. And those are all non-sensory realities, and so that's often forgotten. Mm. You couldn't even do empirical science without relying, first of all, on these non-sensory capacities. Steiner just wanted to develop them farther. I think of it in this way. The quantum physicist David Bohm once said that every really original idea comes through what he called an act of insight. And he defined not through calculation, not through discursive normal reason, but through insight. And he defined insight as a highly concentrated, powerful force of thinking that penetrates the given into the realm of the creative. And that's what I see Steiner trying to do, to go into that insight realm and then to develop it as far and as high as one possibly could. Hmm. So that's the way I would interpret clairvoyance in this sense.
Thank you. That's actually really helpful. I think you answered what I was getting at there. And what's amazing to me is, you know, people, this can be hard for people to process sometimes the concepts or the ideas or what the whole idea of quantum physics, quantum physics actually is a little easier for people than when you say words like spirituality, because right. spirituality, they identify with the New Age movement of this sort of something that's based in non-reality or something. But
well, for me, if you think of the spiritual as the opposite of the sensory, mm-hmm. not the opposite, but it's different. It's the non-sensory realities
right.
in which we all live. When we think, we're in a non-sensory realm.
Right.
Unless you want to reduce thinking to matter, mm-hmm. to the material, mm-hmm. which many people in the modern world do.
Right. Or let your iPhone do it.
That's right.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is what strikes me about his work is that how sometimes difficult it is for people, at the same time, it can't be all that difficult because the work has been so successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking about the Waldorf School movement, the Camp Hill Village movement, right. and the biodynamic movement. Three just spring to mind immediately, and we have those communities in our local communities here around Hudson mm-hmm. in Columbia County. And these are movements that have been amazingly successful in the healing of the soil and the healing of or helping of people with disabilities and with the helping of students in education. Mm-hmm. And they're growing worldwide. And so something obviously is working here.
Yeah. Just to take the education movement as an example, there are probably 900 schools now worldwide in 6 continents. This country, probably every country in Europe, Egypt, Israel, I'm just, as they come to my mind, mm-hmm. Egypt, Israel, Japan, they're growing like mad in China, I'm told by people who've just come back. Hmm. It's kind of a little explosion of Waldorf education. And it's difficult for somebody who wants to come and just read a book and say, oh, I've read that book and that's it. But it's not so difficult if you really are serious and you want to follow Steiner's train of thought. Then in all of these fields, one has a body of knowledge that one can work with. And it's one that one can, one can explore in ever greater depth. That's one of the strengths of Steiner. You can write it off as difficult, but on the other hand, you can say, oh no, it's so rich that we can keep mining it. It keeps revealing possibilities. Mm. And one doesn't have to believe it. Steiner said, don't believe me. He said, I would hope that you would try to understand me. And he said, you can understand me with good common sense, sound, healthy common sense, and clear thinking. And so in all these areas, if you come at it with that attitude, oh, he's got a lot to tell me here. I'm going to work with it. I'm going to see if it's plausible. I can get on top of it to the extent that I can work with it, and then I'll get on top of more as a result. So you have education, medicine, agriculture, Camp Hill, a whole range of movements that began, most of them began after World War I. Mm-hmm. When mm-hmm. people came to him asking him for help in these different areas, he said, okay, I'll sit with you and I'll work with you.
Yeah, so interesting. So let's back up to the Waldorf School again. The first Waldorf School was in Stuttgart, I believe. And explain that one just briefly, okay. If you don't mind.
Well, there are two subjects here, and I'll just touch on the one because it leads to Waldorf. After World War I, Steiner was very concerned about the anger and the unrest and the almost despair that had covered Europe, and he began to think in terms of social renewal. Mm-hmm. Okay, that led to another whole movement. It also led to the Waldorf movement because the head of the Waldorf Astoria tobacco factory
in Stuttgart
invited Steiner to come and talk to his workers about his new social reform plans. So he came and gave them some lectures. This was 1919. And the workers afterwards came to Emil Molt, who was head of the factory, and said, we're so taken by this that we are wondering if Dr. Steiner would help start a school for our children, which would give them the kind of education we never received. So Molt put the question to Steiner, would you do that for the workers? And he said, I will, if 3 conditions are met. One, these are pretty radical at the time. They're not so radical now. But one was that it has to be a co-ed school, totally co-educational. Mm-hmm. All the children have to follow one comprehensive curriculum so that they're not split up into little specialties that never relate to one another. And he said that all the final authority in pedagogical and educational decisions must rest with the teachers. Mm-hmm. Well, he was given that guarantee that he could do that, and he started the first school in Stuttgart. And it's has grown since. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember, well, I went to Kimberton Waldorf School through 8th grade, and at the time, it was a handful of us. You know, we'd play each other in the basketball tournaments. There's Detroit, Baltimore, Hawthorne Valley, Garden City, or there's the Green Meadow down in Spring Valley. It was literally about six or seven of us, the schools. And yeah. Now how many are in the United States, roughly, do you know?
I don't know roughly. Probably 100.
Oh, wow, yeah. So it's, you know.
It's large, and in addition, there are many preschool programs.
Right, yeah.
I might mention, because people might be wondering, it's kind of interesting that the first school was named the Waldorf School after a tobacco factory.
After a tobacco factory, yeah.
But many people might be wondering, well, this was founded in 1922, and then the Nazis came to power in the 30s. What happened to the schools? Well, the schools were closed by the Gestapo in 1938. And I've seen a copy of the Gestapo report, which reads to the effect that these schools try to develop self-directed individuals for which there will be no place in the Third Reich.
Interesting. So
and
we're
they
talking
need to be closed.
Freedom of thought, free yeah. thinkers.
Yeah. And individual freedom. It's just key in all of Steiner's work. Everybody has a self that deserves to be able to express itself in a free way. So there's nothing dogmatic about anything that Steiner ever did.
Steiner died somewhat prematurely in 1925, so he would have not been alive during the 30s. No. But they saw his work as being a threat to the Third Reich, you're saying?
Hitler attacked Steiner as early as 1921 in a magazine article.
Interesting.
Then in 1922, he was giving a lecture in Munich, and proto-Nazis stormed the stage in an assassination attempt, and the young people around Steiner formed a wall and helped him escape. In 1923, Hitler's putsch in Munich, you know, where he tried to take power and failed, Steiner commented to somebody, if these people ever come to power, I'll never be able to step foot in Germany again. So they saw that he was a threat if they allowed him to persist.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
He died too early for a real engagement to take place between them, but it had already started as early as 1921.
Mm-hmm. And he founded also a world view, or he's... I kind of promulgated a worldview called anthroposophy, mm-hmm. and we haven't really touched too much on that. The word itself, I mention it to folks, and it seems that it's not anthropology, and you know.
Well, let's take that. You know, it does strike many people as a jawbreaker and a mouthful, anthroposophy. But think about it for a minute. You mentioned anthropology. Mm-hmm. Anthropology is not that foreign, but it's not that different. It's a Greek word, anthropos, for the human being. And it's a Greek word, logos, which has come to be kind of narrowly defined from its original meaning, but as study. So we say okay. anthropology as the study of the human being. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to anthroposophy. Anthropos is the same word for the human being. And instead of logos, you have sophia, which is the Greek word for wisdom. So anthropology is the study of the human being. Anthroposophy, anthroposophia, is the human is the wisdom of the human being. And Steiner even later in his life said that he would actually prefer that anthroposophy be interpreted not as the wisdom of the human being so much as the recognition of our essential humanity. Huh. So he wanted to keep it alive. And that's the word that he used for all of his work. It was anthroposophy or anthropos sophia, the wisdom of the human being.
Okay.
So it's not such a jawbreaker if right. you kind of break it down.
So Sophia. So you got to get to know
right.
wisdom of the world. So he, this anthroposophy, and it's not a system of dogmatic thoughts. It's not like in any way, like say, for example, the Catholic Church has a pretty rigorous sort of outlook on life, and you kind of have to follow it. This is more of an inner path.
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can understand it in several ways, but this is the way I like to understand it. Steiner claimed it was a science of spirit, a science of values, meaning, qualities, so forth, or a science of consciousness. And he maintained that it's a mistake in the modern world to think that science should only be applied to quantities. It could also be applied to the non-sensory and to qualities. Because the essence of science, he maintained, and now there's some philosophers of science who would agree with this, that science should not be defined by its object or its subject matter, material, quantities, but by its method. And its method consists of thinking and clear observation and verification under certain circumstances. And that's the method. And so he called anthroposophy also spiritual science. He saw it as a science. Now, where it gets complicated for a lot of people is that I see two parts in this spiritual science. One is the method. And he gave many exercises, meditations, directives, whereby that capacity for doing spiritual science can be developed by everybody. But it also has a lot of content that's supplied by Steiner himself in his own, from his own investigations. And here's the crucial thing. One does not have to believe or accept any of this content, although it fills these 400 volumes. And my way of thinking about the content is these are Steiner's reports of his investigations. And they're not teachings. They're reports that you can take or leave. If you find them plausible, you can work with them. Mm-hmm. You still don't have to believe them to work with them. But it's there for you to see if it begins to make sense and if you can work with it. So in biodynamic agriculture, he has these reports. If you want to do this, here's what's going to happen. If you do the preparations and if you do the kind of planning of the farm in this way, you will get these results. And so the farmers tried it. They got these results. And I think that's been a big thing in biodynamics is that, his ideas have results. It's not a matter of believing them. It's a matter of looking at the results. Mm-hmm. Same mm-hmm. in education, same in medicine.
Proof is
in the
pudding.
Now, does that clear? Does that make sense? Am I
right.
making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. The proof is in the pudding, as mm-hmm. they say. And I think the approach of leaving people in complete freedom to take it or leave it is so effective. And I think that's what people really need these days, especially everyone's kind of...
If it's not too scary.
Right.
And then people tend to go back into the collective and the tribe and the community to escape freedom.
Right.
But Steiner said, you must be free.
Or they ignore the scaring parts. It's interesting. Yeah, I was on the West Coast. My brother started a compost company out there.
Mm-hmm.
First Demeter certified biodynamic compost, actually. Malibu compost, and it's amazing with the wine industry, especially mm-hmm. how this has caught on the West Coast, and biodynamics is now a buzzword in mainstream agricultural speak and agri-speak or whatever, mm-hmm. and part of it has to do with, wine folks are very, very particular about taste, and the blindfolded taste tests just simply did not lie, apparently. So now a lot of these vineyards want to be biodynamic, which is tricky when you're a monoculture.
That's right.
So a lot of these vineyards have chickens running around and vegetables growing off on the side. So it's just interesting, diversification of the fields and whatnot. And I see nothing but positive work coming out of that in particular. So we have the schools, we've touched on the agriculture,
mm-hmm.
we've talked a little bit about Camp Hill.
Right.
He influenced, you're saying, art and architecture greatly and still does to this day.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's regarded, I think, I'll say this conditionally, but I think by many art historians as really a leading figure in pioneering modern architecture. Mm-hmm. Because the first Goetheanum that I mentioned, the first building, the wooden building, was burned down mm-hmm. in 1922. And he immediately set about designing a new building, but a totally different design. Mm-hmm. He never really let anything rest in the old. So he started, and so he designed a building of a new technique of poured, sculpted, reinforced concrete. Now, it was finished after his death, but the whole design was his. And it's regarded as one of the major pioneering architectural forms of the 20th century.
So this
by many artists.
Yeah, I've never been there. I've seen photos, but this would be the second
Goetheanum. That's the second Goetheanum, as it's called.
Okay, also in Dornach.
In Dornach,
Switzerland.
Right, actually on the spot, on the original spot of the first Goetheanum. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Let's see, where else could we touch upon?
Well, one other thing I might mention,
because
we talked about freedom,
yeah,
is that there are no requirements for membership in the Anthroposophical Society, except one. No requirements as regard race, religion, nationality, economic or social standing. There's only one requirement, and that is that you think that it's a good idea to have something like the Goetheanum doing spiritual research. It doesn't even have to be this Goetheanum. In fact, it's kind of self-evident. If you're going to join the society, there's one thing you ought to agree on, and that it's a good thing to have. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's totally free and open. You can join it out of curiosity, and he would welcome that. Come and see what we're doing, mm-hmm. you know.
So the Goetheanum would be the center of anthroposophical work and the center of the Anthroposophical Society, which is an international entity or society.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Fantastic. And so back to this weekend. So it sounds from what we've been talking about here, it is a good idea to celebrate his 150th birthday and to acknowledge the amazing work and contributions that he's made. A lot of people are unaware. It's amazing how insightful this guy was and how extensive his writings and lectures and work was. But mm-hmm. he also is still a little bit on the, let's say, the underground.
Yes.
And I'm wondering,
particularly in this country,
why do you think that? Oh, right. Well, in Europe, actually, it's very common. The countries actually mm-hmm. fund the schools over there and the Camp Hills and whatnot. It's a totally different thing, I've heard.
Yeah, and the medical movement is well developed in Europe. You have hospitals and clinics, pharmacies. You'll know Valeda and Hauschka are mm-hmm. both come out of biodynamic agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Hauschka, right? The very high quality.
Yeah.
Health and beauty products.
But you're right. He's almost unknown in this country.
Hmm. And why do you think that
is? Well, I think several reasons. One is what we talked about earlier, this sheer scope and breadth of his writings kind of, I think, intimidates people. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know, where do I start?
Right. where do you start, by the way?
But that's a good, in a way, that's an advantage, because you've got riches that keep pouring themselves out in all these different areas. I think another reason why he might be unknown is that many people may think mistakenly that he's a kind of modern-day guru, and they want to shy away from that. He's not a guru. He always said, you know, well, he rejected freedom. He rejected authority from the very start. One of his main books, he always considered it his most important book, was entitled Philosophy of Freedom, mm-hmm. in which he developed the whole notion of thinking, individuality, and imagination in the way in which we solve our ethical problems. Total freedom. He's not a guru. Now, I do think that sometimes anthroposophists admire him so much that there's a kind of reverence that develops, which in some ways runs counter to what Steiner wanted. Mm. Not in some ways, and so it's something that ought to be encouraged. mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But probably the most important reason for his rejection by, say, the sophisticated world is this claim that he had, that it is possible to have genuine knowledge of the non-sensory world that will have consequences for life, for education, for agriculture, for medicine, for the treatment of the people with special needs. Real knowledge of values, meaning, purposes, qualities, and not just taken on faith or tradition or feeling, but genuine knowledge that has consequences in the world. And I think that runs so counter to many people's thinking in the modern world. If you're a dyed-in-the-wool materialist, it's just nonsense, because a dyed-in-the-wool, a real consistent materialist would say we can only have knowledge of the sense world or abstractions from the sense world. None of this stuff about knowledge of values. That's all taste or feeling. And a lot of religious people, particularly most Protestants and Catholics, I think if they really knew anything about Steiner, they would take umbrage. Those who do take umbrage at his claim that what they deal with as a matter of faith can also be dealt with in terms of knowledge. Mm. And knowledge that isn't just an idea, but knowledge that has consequences, as we've been saying. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons.
Okay. Interesting. We actually didn't really touch so much on the Christianity topic, mm-hmm. and Steiner part of his work did involve something I guess I call esoteric Christianity, which is tough for people who are non-Christian and nevertheless spiritual. It's tough for them to accept what Steiner was trying to get at, because there's a Christian element to some of his work. And then for people who are Christians, it's very difficult for them to accept, because his Christian work had an esoteric nature that was counter to almost everything the church had been teaching them for hundreds and hundreds of years. So maybe we should, could you comment
explore that a little bit?
Well, maybe, what is esoteric Christianity?
Well,
maybe
we here's my ask. Understanding now. Take it as mine. The Christ was very important for Steiner. But it was a non-sectarian Christ in the sense that everybody has within them this being or power of love, patience, joy, regardless of religion, nationality, social standing. Everybody has it as a guarantee of their equality and their worth. So already the Christ is a universal being. The Christ also, for Steiner, was the possibility of the unity of all human beings, because all human beings have this value. He was the ground of the individual, of the infinite worth of every individual, for Steiner. Later in his life, Steiner said the time may come when the Christ will be known by another name. And the name's not important. What's important is the reality of the functioning of this power or this being. And it will be a Christ being, whatever the name, if it is working for the unity and the solidarity of all human beings on an equal, free basis. So that, wouldn't go down well with a lot of traditional Christians. In fact, I think these days, when the name Christ has been so abused and used to abuse others, mm-hmm. a change of name might be a good thing.
Right.
That's my own personal, I'll inject that in here. So, but for Steiner, it was not the name so important as the reality of and function of this being.
So the being also more of an impulse rather than a man who walked around and said neat things that were documented by the disciples.
He said that all the teachings of Christ could be found in other religions, mm-hmm. but that what was most important was the deed. And the deed was the entrance into human life of new powers of life and meaning. And that's why he saw it as a turning point, this deed as a turning point in human history, mm-hmm. that new powers of life and meaning were inserted into human history through the actual life and suffering and death of this man, Jesus of Nazareth, mm-hmm. in which the Christ, he saw this power, was present. That's why it's a turning point. There are new possibilities now available to the human being. But they have nothing to do with a sectarian holding onto those powers and the Christ impulse for themselves. It's a worldwide mm-hmm. reality. Mm-hmm. So you have people in Islam who are anthroposophists, mm-hmm. who have no problem with this Christ being and also remaining Muslims. Mm-hmm. Have the same thing in Buddhism. There are Buddhist priests who are members of the Anthroposophical Society and remain Buddhist priests. Mm-hmm. There are Jewish leaders in the society who are Jewish and are anthroposophists. It's a totally non-sectarian view of the Christ as present to every human being, but also not a general bland, oh, he was a good man teaching. The death and the resurrection as a moment in history when new powers of life inserted themselves into the possibility for human beings. We have to respond to them. It's not going to automatically take over. But he described the Christ impulse often, again and again. You use the term, but it's a term he also used, the Christ impulse, the objective working of the Christ being, that, as I've described it, in the world, regardless of how we believe. It's going to be at work. Be at work in promoting freedom, be at work in promoting human equality, be at work in affirming the reality of the individual, the equality of the individual, and at work in developing new ways of knowing that can take into account the non-sensory world. Mm-hmm. Steiner said again and again, and then I'll be quiet, said again and again, if we do not develop these new ways of knowing the non-sensory world, the world of truth, beauty, goodness, being, we only face catastrophe. And that, for, I think, is crucial. I think it's crucial that we realize that if we only stay with the dominant modern notion that knowledge has to do only with what is quantitative and mechanical, count, measure, and weigh, we're heading for some very, very big catastrophes. Mm-hmm. Steiner saw that. He tried to provide another way of knowing that would go beyond that and make new possibilities a reality.
Wow. So sounds like he was foreseeing quite a lot there, and we have a duty to respond. And it was just, I think we're probably running a little bit out of time.
Okay.
So that's an interesting spot to start wrapping it up. But I'm at the very end here. I'm going to throw you a curveball.
Uh-oh.
And I'm going to ask whether or not you feel like that very real, that possibility of really feeling that impulse or really responding to the needs of the world, whether we might be getting closer to that, and whether Wall Street, I wanted to ask you about Wall Street, what's happening down there with the occupation, whether there might be hope in something like that, or what are your feelings of, are you optimistic or pessimistic, I guess is what I'm asking.
Steiner gave a lecture later in his life in which he said, there is such a thing as a justifiable pessimism if it serves to wake us up. But then he went ahead to say, but we ought not to be either optimistic or pessimistic. We should do our work. Because either one can lead us off into either a Pollyannish, oh, it's all going to be okay, or nothing good is ever going to happen. And he said, get those two alternatives out of the way and do your work. And that's the way I feel about a lot of the things that are going on. There's a lot of good people out there that in some ways are working fully in ways fully compatible with the Christ impulse. Mm-hmm. And that all has to be encouraged. Whether they don't want to use the name or don't even want to have anything to do with it, it still can be seen from this standpoint as compatible with and encouraging the Christ impulse as I've described it. So I'm all for all these things that are going on. I'm also aware that they often go bad and that we have to kind of keep our bearings about us and not be sucked off into a false optimism or a dire pessimism, but to just keep plugging away.
Do the work, in other words.
Do the work.
Okay. Wow, Douglas Sloan, thank you.
It's been my pleasure. You're welcome.
I'm really glad to have you here. Any parting words you want to leave us with? Well, except we said do the work.
Well, and it's a delight for me to discover, I'm just now, I hate to admit it, your radio station.
Oh, well, we're just getting going. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you could be here in the studio with us. This is Kieran Riley hosting Douglas Sloan in the studio at 90.7 WGXC. And we hope You all take care. And this weekend, once again, starting Friday evening at Space 360 on Warren Street, there's going to be a slew of events, mostly talks being given on the subject of Rudolf Steiner in honor of his 150th birthday. So stay tuned for more on that, and take care.